Blog Talk Radio.
What's up, world, and welcome to Realty Universal Radio, the fastest hour in radio, no doubt about it. I'm Randy Zachary, and this is a show about real estate, about God, about life, about giving back, about being the change in the world that you'd like to see. I'm privileged to bring to you Natalie Mullinex and Realty Universal, a company dedicated to excellence. Realty Universal is a revolution founded on a very simple principle. We believe sellers and buyers should have choices. We have been a pioneer in the menu program system. More on that, of course, a little later. Natalie Mullinex, president and founder of Realty Universal, averaged over $80 million a year in sales prior to stepping back to focus more on building Realty Universal membership network. She's an accomplished speaker, writer, consultant, trainer, and, oh, by the way, mother. She travels worldwide, literally, spreading the gospel, if you will, of Realty Universal. And now, Natalie Mullinex.
Hey, everybody. It's so nice to be here another week and getting a new year starting off right. We had our show last week, and I don't know where everybody is, but if you're in the cold weather, it's going to be over in a couple months, huh? And I'm actually over on the East Coast right now. I'll be back in Hawaii in a couple weeks. And today I'm really, really excited because we have a very well-known person who I also know personally, and I'm so privileged to know him. And it's just, it's so interesting in life. You meet people, you know people, you travel, and only certain people make certain, few people make a big effect on people, and this person that's coming on right now, I'm going to announce, does and has for many years and has affected many people's lives in such a positive way. So today, Chuck Mills is going to talk to us about leadership. Chuck actually was American football coach for over 47 years. He wears the Super Bowl ring from 1966, the very first Super Bowl, where he was an assistant coach at the Kansas City Chiefs. Can't wait to hear about this and how he did all this. So head coach at Pomona College, Indiana University of Pennsylvania, the United States Merchant Marine Academy, Utah State University, Wake Forest University, Southern Oregon University, and United States Coastal Academy. If I missed any, forgive me. You'll have to fill me in. And without further ado, I'd like to welcome Chuck Mills.
Well, hello, Natalie. No, the introduction's fine. I had all those jobs because primarily I couldn't hold one, so I had to keep moving.
Oh, you're fine. Thank you for coming on today. I really, really appreciate it.
Uh-huh.
You're funny.
What can I do for you?
I really wanted to talk about leadership today. You actually, I mean, you're just amazing with what you've done, and you stuck with it from an early age all the way till now. And to do what you've done takes such tenacity and dedication and discipline. So nobody better to talk about leadership than you. Howard, you're over in Hawaii right now, right?
Well, I coached a lot of teams, and people in the stands were convinced I didn't know what I was doing. So I just stayed with it and tried to get it right sometime along the way.
I have a feeling you definitely know what you were doing. Well, tell us, when you were younger, getting into it in the beginning, what prompted you, that you had to get into it, what forced you to push you into that direction?
Well, I really, really don't know. There was nothing. I knew when I was 11 or 12 years old I wanted to have something to do with football. I thought I'd be a great player, but that sure didn't work out. But I always knew I wanted to coach. I never had any doubts about that. I don't know why I thought that so early, but that was always what was in my mind.
Wow, you're so blessed to not so many people don't know what they want to do. So tell us then how you got into it.
Well, I was 21 years old, out of college, and got an assistant coaching job at a high school in Chicago, and then head coach at another high school, and just the jobs would open up. If I thought they were advantageous, I'd put in an application, and for every acceptance I've got, I probably got 50 letters of rejection. So you don't get too confident with that kind of thing. But I just the normal procedure of applying for jobs as they open, and you thought you might be qualified and lucky enough to get hired.
Really? So you had the tenacity to not say no. You just kept 50 up. You just kept doing it. Is that what one trait do you believe all leaders have?
I don't know. I mean, I've thought about it. You know, a lot of times people are called leaders. I think the first thing a person has to decide in their own mind and to be honest with themselves. A lot of times we lie to ourselves. I mean, they'll say we can do this or we can do that. You know, like I can stop skiing or I can stop this or that. But you've got to analyze yourself. And I think the first thing maybe is what kind of a leader are you? Are you a delegator or are you authoritarian? I mean, you've got to know that because it affects who you hire. It affects them and their careers. So if the one thing I think anybody in any leadership position has to know is how they delegate, how they operate. I'm a delegator more than I'm an autocrat. And the advantage of delegating is if you hire good people, then they have some room to maneuver and to create. If you're an authoritarian figure, don't hire any creative people because they'll be so frustrated with you, they won't last long. And I think that's the first thing you have to decide. Then when you put people together to form a unit, this should be the dominant thing. And for me, it was hiring what I thought were good coaches and better coaches than me and let them go. We had guidelines as a head coach and to keep a whole program running in all the facets, which is far beyond just the field. But let them go if they have a response. I think the other thing, if you give somebody, this one to me is a big one. If you give somebody responsibility, give them the authority to execute it. And a lot of people don't do that. They'll tell somebody you're in charge of something, but really they don't have the authority to really do it their way. So I really believe that. If you give somebody a responsibility, give them the authority to execute it, and give them recognition in what they do. It's not going to hurt the head coach any or the leader to give people recognition and to go out of your way to help them and whatever their personal goals are. I think one of the toughest things taking over, if you've been the example I can think of is a salesman. Somebody's a super salesman, the best salesperson a company ever had. And all of a sudden, the job opens up to be a sales manager. And that person's getting the job, and they fail. Because the qualities that made them a good salesman are not necessarily the qualities of the sales manager. I mean,
it's so frustrating.
It is. But that's what I think you have to do. Because the qualities that made a person a good salesman, good salesperson, those aren't necessarily the jobs. I mean, I guess to sum it up in a simple sentence, I would say when you become a leader, you no longer can be a specialist. You've got to be a generalist.
Makes sense.
And too often a generalist never makes that adjustment. I mean, some will just say, oh, he's a specialist. So that's the difference. The leader's got to be a generalist, know a little bit about everything in the organization. The specialist just has to concentrate on their particular area.
That's a really good way to put it, because and I can tell you, we have a lot of people that will be listening. A lot of people listen at later times, et cetera, are also real estate agents and brokers in other areas besides public. And that's something I think a lot of brokerages have trouble with. I know I've had trouble with it when you're used to being the salesperson and then you have to delegate and let everybody run. It's a difficult place, and it's not comfortable either. I think it's very uncomfortable if you're used to getting things done and getting it done, and then you have to delegate, and you're right. That makes sense. It's a very difficult place to be. Well, would you recommend everybody assessing who, like when they're going to hire people, a leader has to hire people under them. In football, in college, I don't know how did you assess people to find out who was right for the job, or did they have to have a lot of experience before you even considered them?
Well, no. I mean, it's like anything else. There's people you know that there's certain people you meet just through the years you have contact with in your profession, and you know they're top-flight people, and if a job opens up on your staff or in your organization, you think of that person, and one of the strongest support somebody could have, if I had somebody working for me and they recommended somebody, I would seriously look at that person. Because if they were working in our organization, I'm satisfied with them, and we have pretty strong requirements about wanting good people. And if somebody recommends a friend, the first assumption I would make, and very seldom wrong, is, well, if so-and-so thinks this is a good guy, then he's a good guy. I mean, because I wouldn't see my associate being a good guy and have a bad guy for a friend. They usually have the same rules. And so that was an inside track, because I had a lot of coaches through the years. I mean, over the years, probably I hired 140 or 50 of them.
Wow.
That was, I probably hired more based primarily on what people on my staff, and I hate the word my, it's always our, people on our staff would recommend somebody, and I would really look in. Let me check with people that they work for, and coaching is a little bit different. I mean, it's the same in your business, but, you know, you associate a lot of other coaches from other schools, and you know a lot about a lot of people just from casual conversations over the years.
Oh, that's fantastic.
So that's about that.
Well, and the I would imagine, how did you be with leadership, being a head the coach for so many years, and you were dealing with men, particularly men, right, at college level? I mean, college age, right?
Just for the record, I offered a football coaching position to a woman in 1986, and she would have been good. And when it came down to hiring her, she decided she didn't want to do it. So I would have taken.
Good
I would have
you.
Done it.
Good
well,
for
she
you.
Was
good
coach.
For you.
She coached women's sports, and she was an excellent coach, and could fit into what we were doing and get her trained in a certain area of football in a short period. She would have been good. She would have been good. But
wow.
She you know, when it came down to the signing time.
Oh, because it how about the that's because now I think it's, I don't know if it's changed a lot or not, because you still see quite a lot of men in it, but how about the actual players that are mostly, I mean, they're dealing with the men and having to lead them and being the head coach and overseeing the other ones, was that because they're in college football and they're going up from there, they're very determined typically, the players, or do there were a lot of issues that you had to work through with between grades and family and other things?
Oh, there's a lot of things you do. When you're dealing with, say, in college, an average 20-year-old, you know, a 20-year-old kid, you know, maybe a couple of years older or younger. But there's all kinds of things you've got to go through with them. I mean, you get involved in their family problems, and you get some kids that are good athletes and good football players, but they're not very good people. And find that out, you just can't keep them around, but you don't know until you work with them. And the thing that's sad is that they really don't get smart until about 24 or 25. I mean, and they look back and say, boy, was I stupid, you know.
Oh, because they're just too young and they're making mistakes and regretting it? Okay.
Well, it's not even a mistake. An attitude is the way they live. You get some young people, you know, they're away from home for the first time in a college campus, and they go goofy. Or you get kids that come from terrible homes. And usually if they get with the team and stay with it for a couple of years, they'll conform. You'll get kids that conforming with the societal rules is necessary to be in the team, so they just figure they want to play more than they want to run around, so they'll conform. But you've got to be consistent with your policies, but you can't be consistent in how you apply it. If that makes sense.
So
I mean,
we had certain rules
the kids had to follow, but the way you approach the kids in following the rules, it's not the same with every kid. I mean,
because you're individually, so you're actually kind of dealing with their temperament or their personalities and learning and kind of adjusting depending on the issue and who you're dealing with. I mean, really managing, leading them really had to build a trust with them because, right, they had a strong trust, I would think.
That's right. They've got to trust you. They don't even, don't have to like you, but they can, they feel they trust you. They feel you're being fair with them. And for a group, now you're talking about a team that's very tightly knit and they're together for a few years, but your present players that are in your program usually are the ones that break through the kids that are problems because they're teammates. And if you've got good leaders on your team and good solid kids in the team, that spreads to the whole team. If you've got a team full of bums, you're going to have a bunch of bums playing football. And probably the biggest factor were the kids on the team that would look after them and get them in line because they were leaders and they were good athletes and they were smart kids. And I always call them kids, but they're older than that. But that was sort of
I know. We all do that as we get older, though.
In our program, we always had our teams always had quite a few really, well, a lot. I think all of them, you'd like to think, were really pretty good kids. So when somebody new came in, and oftentimes the new guy would make changes to fit in with the group. Because if he was some kind of a wild hare someplace, he wouldn't fit in, and the players on the team didn't want anything to do with him.
Oh, did it? That's quite a lot of people to be able to get them to do what they're supposed to do.
Peer pressure is going to open the door, I think, as whoever the coach was, an assistant coach or the head coach, whoever the coach was, had to give guidance. But you can't treat every kid the same. Some kids you got to get hard on them. Other kids you got to treat them gently. But you don't know what their self-perception is. They may come out and look like they're one way, but underneath the surface, they're nothing like that at all. And so you've got to, as I say, a policy doesn't change, but how you apply it does. What your approach is as a part to
have. When you're leading like that, how long do you think it took about to get? I mean, like say just on the average, because you know so many things are repetitive. When you're dealing with a group and each player is a different. For you to really see their true colors, did it take a month, 2 months, 6 months? I mean, and people in general, when you're in a leadership position.
Usually within a year, you can decide if they could be recycled. If you had a kid that, unlike in business, and like the business you're in, you can't afford to wait for somebody to come around in a year or two. Now, they may blossom a year or two. They may blossom, but fundamentally, when they come to work for you, they've got to know how to do the job, and they got to do it. And if they don't do it, they'll starve to death or get fired or something. Well, with the athletic end of it, it's a little bit different because the kid is in school and he's playing a sport, so it's a little bit different with him. But you couldn't get somebody
in for the year. You got it.
And you can decide in the time and say, well, this person, if they'll do this and they'll do that, they got a future. There's other people, if you're honest with them, you say you're wasting your time.
You know, that's right. One thing I've noticed, like with leadership, well, and then we'll get into the other side too with military and things, but with leadership and say you go and you have you're starting your career, you're doing your businesses and you start having successes and the successes can feel great and you look at it a lot, I find, differently as we get older and look over life. But how did it feel? Because you actually were pretty much in the beginning, right? A couple years after you were with the Kansas City Chiefs assistant coach when they were in the Super Bowl, the very first Super Bowl. Tell us how that felt to you, and you were quite young at that time. When I mean young, I mean, you know, in doing your position, right?
I was rather young, but when I was with the Chiefs in 1966, I was, I think, 34, 35 years old. I forget, 36
maybe.
So
you'd already been doing this for a while. Okay.
I've already been coaching for a number of years, and I got hired there because I had known the head coach for years and years, and I was out of a job, and he brought me in as an assistant, and it turned out well for me.
Wow. How did it feel, though, to have that much recognition that somebody doing that with the team? That had to just feel so great to get into the Super Bowl. I mean, just tell us, like, that the euphoria.
That was a big thrill at that time in the first Super Bowl. It wasn't that big a deal. I mean, it was the same kind of game, but it was between two leagues, and really nobody ever knew if the Super Bowl would take over as such. We were champions of our league, and you're playing in a big game with big publicity and two networks televising it, and so that was a kick. But you're dealing with grown men. I mean, there were a few players on the team though that were older than me, and most of those guys are in their middle 20s or their middle 30s, so they're productive men. They're not young kids anymore, and you have to be completely different in how you deal with them. I couldn't deal with them in an autocratic way because they were all bigger than me, my same age, and sure, five times better athletes than I ever dreamed about being. So, being successful at that level of pro football, they've all got pretty big egos.
I can imagine. But so you didn't nobody knew then it was the first Super Bowl, which is history to be in the first Super Bowl, that it was going to turn out the way it is, huh? That was just the start of it.
Well, that way it turned out the way they hoped and dreamed. But the first one, I mean, a lot of people don't realize the first Super Bowl, there were only about 30,000 people there in the Los Angeles Coliseum. And, then it just grew from there and it took off. But that first one, we were in it and it was this first Super Bowl, and last year was the 50th Super Bowl, so this one coming up in February will be the first.
Wow, and you were in the very first.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
I love it, I love it, I love it. And you wear the Super Bowl ring?
Oh, well, not as much as I used to. I'm getting older, and I'm getting skinny and losing weight and falling apart with age.
Oh.
Sometimes it falls off, but usually I'll wear it and I'll walk around with my ring finger next to my cheek the whole day.
You don't want to lose that. That's so funny. I love it. I love it. It's just amazing though to stick through that all so long. So when you you were also at the United States Coast Guard Academy, and the United States Merchant Marine Academy, was that the Merchant Marine Academy was what, back in the 60s, and then the Coast Guard was late 90s, I believe?
The year I coached at the Coast Guard, I was the athletic director there for a decade. Then next to last year, our coach left on short notice, and the superintendent of the academy wanted me to take the team for a year. And I didn't want to do it because I hadn't coached for 10 years. And he sort of insisted, and it's the military, and even if you're a civilian, you got the chain of command. So I met with the players and told them what the superintendent wanted. And I said, I won't do it if you don't want it. And they agreed to do it, and we ended up winning the most games they ever won in the season.
Congratulations.
So,
see, they knew you would do it. They knew. You already had the – I mean, you – oh, my gosh, that's amazing. That's fantastic.
You don't do much. You don't have good players. You don't do much anything. You better have good players out there that can do it. The coach
and
can
that's
know
something
what
else.
Got to do
you know,
it.
You're an awesome leader. You just don't want to take credit for it, but you deserve credit for it. You really do. You absolutely
well,
do.
Well, I take credit that we can put a program together and we can operate a program. Any success we had in playing the football, it was staff and good kids playing for you. I mean, kids that could play football and wanted to and were loyal to it, and they stayed loyal to each other ever since. I've got about 600 former players on my mailing list that I'm in contact with all the time.
Oh, I love it. 600. Oh, my gosh, I love it. That's just so amazing. You've affected their lives forever.
Yeah,
I remember
different schools, and they stay in contact. And we've had three or three or four gatherings in Las Vegas, and about 100 guys will show up from the different schools, and we have a couple of days together. So a lot of all of them I pretty much followed their whole lives.
Oh, wow.
And they've kept me alive, and they've kept me charged up. So it's been a great deal.
It's family. It's family, and they're never you've had such lasting effects on them, and that's just it's awesome, an awesome place to be. The kind of leadership I have to do isn't fun. It's a different it's a different world. It's just a different industry, and it's but wow, you have a huge coaching record. I was just, and you're on this. This is amazing. I just love it. Did you find when you were with the Coast Guard Academy or Merchant Marine Academy, with the Coast Guard Academy specifically, because these guys were through the military Marines, I mean, Marines is very disciplined, of course, did that help you were these guys like more of a cream of the crop coming in than when the kids are young getting in, or does that not make it as far as not, I don't mean,
well, they're not,
maybe
they're
not
over
talent,
there
but,
in the Coast Guard Academy, the kids are essentially college-age kids. They come into high school.
Okay.
Once in a while, there'll be a few that are older that have been in the regular Coast Guard and qualify to get into the academy. But you're dealing with, every kid in the team at the Coast Guard Academy is a engineering major. I mean, they got four or five different engineering schools, and they're the cream of the crop academically. And the discipline of the academy, I mean, you have to be extra relaxed with them, because we did studies. In fact, the Coast Guard did a study that for the 4 years that those kids were in the academy, they averaged 5.5 hours sleep a night. I mean, they stay all night. It's a tough grind. It's a tough grind, but they all come out in good shape. It's a good outfit.
Wow, amazing, fantastic foundation in the beginning. I mean, it's. Do you think maybe we should have like some countries, that say once you're 18, you go in the military for 2 years? Do you think that would be a good thing to do?
If I were the dictator of the world or the dictator of the United States, I would have every kid come out of high school for 2 years and do some kind of public service. Go in the military for 2 years, do some kind of public service work, because you get a minimum of about 20 or 21, and a lot of the foolishness is out of their system. And they all come in. What we have in our society is we developed, and I'm not talking about the left or the right, I'm just sorry, in general, we've got anybody that doesn't want to do anything, they don't do it. And I don't care whether they protest or just, they don't do it. Well, they need to go someplace. When somebody tells them to do something, you do it. My boss told me to do this, I'm doing it.
Right.
And they don't have that kind of self-discipline, And so I would think it would be great. You'd have a lot more successful kids just being in that environment where you can learn that everything's not going to be your way, and you're going to have to do some things you don't like, and you do them. If those academy kids, a Coast Guard officer or a teacher tells them to do something, there's no debate about it. I mean, it's done. It's done. Or they're gone.
Exactly.
And so from that standpoint, I'm sure somebody could argue against it with me, but and they could maybe win the argument. But as an overall statement, if I use college as a barometer, since that's where I was most of the time, when a kid gets into college at 20, he's a heck of a lot different than when he gets into college at 17.
Those 2 years make such a difference at that age. Yes.
They've got to learn how to function within a group. And there's a difference between functioning within a group and functioning within a gang. The hierarchy.
Within a gang,
different.
Okay.
It's a whole different. I mean, it's leadership. I mean, a gang leader is a gang leader, but it's just a different outlook, a whole deal. As I say, you come out of the military, I mean, somebody's a superior officer or your boss or something, they tell you to do something, you do it. I mean, we've got kids now.
They respect it and they do it, right? Exactly. Well, nowadays, it's just getting so out of hand that the respect level, I think, is changing in the generations I see. And well, I'm concerned with social media.
It's got a lot to do with technology and kids know, you know, so much more than when I was a kid. You know, the kids today know. So I still have to battle with the cell phone. You know, I'm seeing, you know, 5 or 6 year olds sitting on a table on a cell phone.
I know, exactly.
I mean, it's it's a whole different environment, and maybe it's not necessarily better before. It's just something different that I don't understand. And but they live with it. In 20 years, we probably won't talk anymore at all. We'll just be on the phone all the time.
You know,
is
a shame, though.
We'll
see people out eating dinner, and there's a couple together, a family, and everybody's on the cell phone. You know, it's kind of a shame that we're losing some of that touch.
I see it every day. You see, I mean, go someplace with a couple of people dating. I mean, say in their early 20s, they're on a date. I'll assume a date, but I see it over and over.
Right.
They're sitting there at the table eating, and each one is talking to somebody on the phone. They never talk to each other.
It's terrible. I think it's
Well, maybe it isn't. Maybe it isn't because, you know, we go back to different generations and different, you know, we probably do the same thing they're doing in some different way. But, as you know, to say they're wrong, but it sure doesn't look like they're cooperating or being too interested in each other. And,
right.
And that sort of bothers me. But, I mean, that's the way it is. You know, that's the way it is. I walk around with a Bluetooth sticking out of my ear so they just think I know how to use a cell phone.
Oh, that's funny. That's so funny. You, it's amazing. With leadership, now you said you've got about over 600 former players. Did you find with the structure and the foundation and everything they've learned that they've gone on, most of them on an average, really went on to lead really successful lives or happy lives, let's say happy,
with
training?
Yeah, but the thing, yes. But of the 600, and I don't know how many, there's always a whole bunch that fall through the cracks. I mean, nobody can find them. You know, and, I mean, a good number of kids. So the ones you're in contact with are the ones that want to be in contact with you. But there's a whole bunch of kids. Every 3 or 4 months, I go through old football programs looking up names. And I'll see the name of some kid, and I'll say whatever's happened to him. And so a lot of them fall through the cracks, and those guys don't want to be found. They don't want to associate with their teammates. They don't want to, because somehow or other, a lot of them think they've, you know, maybe they've been failures. And so we have a program where every year I ask the guys I've got, and I've got a pretty good list of the people, and say, you know, who is an old teammate that was you were close to that you've fallen out of contact with? I said, let's try and find them. And And sometimes they'll find the guy, and the guy's glad to hear from him. You know, he just went and lived his own life doing fine. And some other guys, you know, I'll get word back, hey, coach, he didn't want to be found, you know. And you just let him go. I mean, but, you know, they stay in contact with each other. And from our get-togethers every few years, the guys from different schools have become friends. And going into business together. I'm not helping you with what you're saying, but I mean, as I say, there's guys that fall through the crack that you forget about them, and you see your name, and then you start checking with some teammates. So we got a deal going where every year each guy's got to find one old teammate that he had.
I love it. That's great.
Yeah, well, during Christmas we had not a cop week. Not a cop week.
NOD.
With all this going on with the police and stuff, I got the guy in there. I had a number of guys. I said, you're not going to go on the streets and demonstrate. But I said, with all this and all this pressure on the police and the way they're being talked about, so every time you see a cop during Christmas for 2 weeks, just if you see him and you're walking down the street, make eye contact and nod your head.
Oh, that's great.
And they'll understand what it is. And a lot of guys did it and said they got reactions from the cops.
Really?
And,
that means
you see them and
a lot.
You know, when you car pulls up next to them, and they look over and just nod their head, you know, like, hello. And so this works a little bit. They liked it.
I love it. I love it. Because, you know, everybody needs, no matter where they are, what they are, they need to feel accepted. They need to feel part of something, you know,
right.
Usually, right? And yeah.
You know, and I've got a lot of guys that are, you know, very successful professionals, and they're not going to go down the street in your alley. But you can give support to whoever it might be, a policeman, a fire. You can give support, but every time you see one or see him, just nod your head. Just say, that's a greeting. And it doesn't take them long. I've had four or five police departments, somebody told them about it, or a cop asked the guy why he was not in. I've gotten letters from four or five police departments saying how much they appreciated it, you know, just a courtesy. But it's little things like that you can make up. You're not going to go on the, somebody successful is not going to go on the streets and demonstrate, you know.
Right.
They haven't got time for it.
Right.
And, but anyway, we're getting way off the subject.
I love it. No, that's not off the subject, because I think being a leader, you're such a leader and you care about people and you really, really do care, and you know how to, it's good to do the camaraderie and give back and show, you know, like that's, those makes such a difference. I was in Manhattan last month and I took different cabs instead of the metro. Well, it's not a metro, it's like the metro, because I wanted to just talk to different, you know, meet different people when I was there in the middle of different meetings, and different cab drivers had different opinions of everything. And one cab driver said to me, because I was like, hi, he's like, if you say that to everybody on the road up there, they're going to think you're crazy. You can't smile and be nice to everybody. And I thought, yes, I can. But he was just saying that it's so different in different places, you know. And by the time we finished and he was dropping me off at the station, you know, we had a great conversation and had a good time talking. You know, it's just some people have different takes on things. I love this about not a cop, nod your head. I love it.
Yeah, it's really easy to do. I'm fine with it, easy to do. I mean, you know, try to look him in the eye and just nod your head. He understands what you're doing. I mean, he's under pressure, or she's under pressure, being a cop, to thinking, people, you know, when I get a ticket, I'm not glad to see him. But, you know, just the acknowledgement that you know they exist and they're doing a good job. Or trying to, anyway.
That means a lot. It's just I've got a question for you. It's a Utah State head coach. Okay, you did. Oh my gosh, the teams really did well with you there. It says, I've got down here, it says you took the first American college football team to Japan, and the Japanese equivalent of the Heisman Award, known as the Mills Trophy, is presented to the top college football player in Japan each year. Tell us about that. Congratulations.
Well, that was, in fact, this year is the 34th year they've given the trophy. We made arrangements at Utah State. Japan has been playing football since the early 1920s, and it's nothing like ours. Their kids weren't big enough. I mean, they were well coached and all that, and so they wanted a U.S. team, and I knew a coach over there, and we put it together. The interesting story in that is Nixon was president. He was a big football fan, so we made arrangements to play in Japan, and I notified the NCAA that we were, you know, wanted permission to play in Japan. It was a week, Christmas week, actually, and the NCAA said they had no rules to let us go. I mean, we couldn't go play, but they had no rules, no bylaws to let us go. I said, do you have any bylaws to stop us? I said, you must not have any to stop us then. And he was sort of dumbfounded. And he said, oh, this is the ruling, you can't go. Well, when Nixon was president, and he's a big football guy, Nixon, one of the guys that was one of his advisors was from Utah. And he heard about this. He didn't hear it from me. I don't even know his name. And he went to Nixon and told him what had happened, and Nixon called up the NC2A and told them to let us go.
Really?
And,
wow, what a story. I didn't know
Nixon
was
Well, it's when Kissinger had just opened up talks with China. And so Nixon told him that he thought the future of Eastern-Western relationships was based on the young people, and he thought our college kids associating with their college kids could only help the opening up of Asia, and they let us go. So
Congratulations.
I wasn't a Ray Nixon fan, but he's one of my heroes when we come to that story.
Hey, he's, yeah, you know, every, yeah, it's been 30, over 34 years now they're doing it. Wow.
Yeah, 34 years they've been doing it. Yeah, they do it at the end of the year at the national championship game. Yeah, it's nice, you know, it's nice. And I get over there once or twice a year, you know, and I enjoy going. Barbara's, my wife's ashes are over there in a Buddhist cemetery in Kobe, Japan.
Tell us about Barbara, because I know that, I mean, and because you definitely, I think you had to fight for Barbara too, right, as being a leader? Just tell us a little bit about
her. I don't know if I was a leader, but I wasn't going to lose. I asked her for 10 years to marry me, and she said no. And then she said yes, and just about blew the wind out of my sails.
You chased her for 10 years?
Yeah. And, and finally she said yes, and when she said yes, I thought, what am I doing? But I chased her for 10 years, and I wasn't going to lose. And so when she finally won, and she accepted, then I wondered what have I done here? She died, 6 weeks after our 40th wedding anniversary.
Right? Oh, my gosh,
but anyway,
I'm so sorry. No,
and
then when go ahead.
Yeah, well, and, you know, the thing is, something that may be of interest to people is when your partner passes, you have all kinds of doubts. I mean, you know, you should have done this, you should have done that. And, I didn't do anything wrong, but I realized I didn't give enough attention to her. And, I mean, just playing everyday attention. Football, besides the game, is emotional. You're emotionally wrapped up in it. And, you assume your partner understands. That your partner understands that this is the way it is. You got to travel. You got to do all this. And then I finally put it out together, and your partner understands it intellectually, but not emotionally. So some of these people that work 24 hours a day or they're gone every night, they think their family understands it. You know, for the man, you know, I'm trying to support my family and feed my kids and all that kind of stuff, and this is what I have to do. And the spouse understands it intellectually, yes, but emotionally she's still deprived, and she doesn't get over that, you know. And but anyway, we're off the subject here. If you want to be a good leader, just
all about
better salesman.
It's still about leadership. You fought for her and you won, and no, it's just a, but I think no, I think she must have adored you, I can imagine, and I know you probably gave her all the ample time, too. I knew it. You're right, we do feel that when we lose our loved ones, but I think that's everybody does, you know, and I don't think she would be saying that. Well, tell me, what did she love about Japan? I mean, with Japan, for you to put her ashes there and not in the U.S., there must be
something. Way off the 70s, she just thought, you know, she was a good Polish girl, good Catholic Polish girl from South Chicago. But the minute she set a foot in Japan, she said, I've been here before. And, she really believed that. And then the Japanese, she got close to them, so they asked for some of her ashes, and they built a little in one of the Japanese, as they say, in a Buddhist cemetery, and got her headstone and everything else. And every month they go and clean the grave. And then send me an email and said, we went to clean the grave. Barbara was glad to see us. So,
aww.
Yeah.
Special.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah,
special.
But anyway. What else
no,
can
that's
I tell you about
that's part of being a leader, too, because there's so much, you know, emotional. And if you don't care, you can't. I don't know how. I think all leaders have to care, right? I mean, I just think most of them, not all, not everybody, but most, to be able to hang in there and do it, because it's. You're giving so much of yourself when you're leader, right? You really are.
Well, yeah, no, you're right. I mean, being a leader has a nice sound to it, but it's got a lot of responsibility that isn't directly related to their career. You just the illness is in the family. I mean, if you're sincere about it, you care about everything that happens to them.
Right.
And it's So you take a lot of their worries home with you. And at the same time, it helps them is that you become somebody they can vent to and get some things off their mind that they can't tell anybody else. And they'll tell you because you're not a direct threat to them, but you're emotionally involved with them. You know, I mean, they're not just martinets that you don't care about. At least that's where I'm coming from. And then not everybody, as you say, not everybody's that way. But in the leadership thing, by golly, you better decide what kind of a leader you are and follow it, and follow what you are. Don't try to make yourself something you aren't, because you're not going to do it.
I agree with you, because I think when you're trying to do it, you're just not happy. What you can tell that it just doesn't work. It doesn't fit or feel right or something. Maybe your strengths are elsewhere. It's I think that we have to follow our heart. Would you agree that we still have to follow our heart no matter what we're doing?
Yeah, I haven't quite figured out what that is, but yeah, I mean, I've been lucky. I mean, very fortunate, and I did what I wanted to do. And I remember my father telling me two things do and two things don't. He said, do what you want and marry who you want. Don't fool around with somebody else's money and don't fool around with somebody else's wife. And that was his advice to me.
Very, very wise man. I love that advice.
Yeah.
That is perfect. I love it. It's just been so great for you to come on today. It's so amazing being able to talk to you and everybody listen. Your advice, I mean, you've just given so much advice, and it really, really, people need it.
As long as I don't have to live up to my advice.
Yes,
please. Yeah, all right. It's another rule. You don't have to live up to your advice.
Yeah.
Okay.
That is okay. Hey, Chuck, I want to thank you so much for coming on today, too, and you've been wonderful. And I'm going to take some of that advice to heart myself. See, and you said out of everything you said today, just going to wrap it up real quick, everything you said, the one trait that all leaders have, would you say is what?
The one thing
never
all
met
leaders
one without
have?
It.
That would be tough. I mean, every leader's got something different. But I don't know, somewhere or other they've got... I don't know. I think the people you're working for, really, as a leader, you're working for them and for them to do better, is I think that they've got to know that, that you care. You care about them beyond just the job. And if they know that, they'll put it. And I think the other thing goes right along with it is if you ask me, as I pondered, I hadn't really thought about it. I think the leader has to be sincere. And that's a big one because if you're sincere and they know you're sincere, people will put up with a lot of the leader's shortcomings if they know the person's sincere. If they're insincere and they know it, you're not going to get anything out of them. It's who can cheat who attitude. And,
right, that makes sense.
I just think they've got to be sincere with their people. And if you're sincere, they'll put up with a lot of this leader shortcomings because the leader has shortcomings. And they're magnified because everybody's concentrating on the one leader. So he or she has got more bad stuff than they think. But if you're sincere, they'll tolerate it.
I love it. Excellent. Thank you so much. I cut you long. Yeah, thank you, thank you, thank you. And you're wonderful, Chuck Mills. And thanks again. And to everybody
out
there. All right,
Natalie. I hope everything goes well for you. And watch out for the snow.
Oh, no, I'll be back real soon. To everybody out there, I wish you peace.
Thank you for joining us on Realty Universal Radio. Our hope is that you are enlightened, encouraged, and mobilized to be an agent of change. Realty Universal is on Facebook. Join us there. Follow us also on Twitter at Realty Universal. And for more information, you can go to RealtyUniversal.com. Make it a great day.